Okay.
Right. Okay. Hopefully you've had time to read all the names. Again, John Beck and Rick Bogart were the guys that put together this data for me from MDI. And of course, these guys are critically important in doing all of that. Kurt Bachman's a former solar guy who's now out and teaching at a girls' school in Oklahoma or something. But he was at Birmingham Southern and had a couple of students that worked with me on some of it. And then Sam Hahn is a former student of ST Wu's, who's up in Tennessee and helped with some of this as well.
Did you say down in Tennessee?
Pardon me? For us, it's up. Okay, wake up. There we go. Here's the outline. First of all, I want to spend a couple seconds talking about why bother doing this sort of thing, characterizing photospheric flows. And then the model. What I'm going to do is data simulation. So I will then talk about the data, how it's prepared to look at photospheric flows. I get rid of the P-modes. And by doing this, all of the helioseismologists call me a bottom feeder. There's the axisymmetric flows that I'm not going to spend any time on. I talked about that earlier in the session, and there's a lot of stuff out there on it already. The primary thing I'm going to look at is in the next part, which is the convection spectrum, the cellular flows, first of all for the poloidal component, and then getting out a radial flow part, the toroidal flow part, look at angular momentum fluxes, rotation rate lifetimes, and then a single conclusion. All right, so why? In my mind, there's three big problems in solar physics, and photospheric flows play a part in all three. The first is what causes the eruption, solar flares, prominences, and CMEs. And there's lots of models now for doing this that require footpoint motion in the photosphere. So photospheric flows at some point that if you move around the magnetic footpoints, you get to unstable configurations and bam, off things go. So there's one place. Another big problem is what causes the 11-year solar cycle. There again, there are models for flux transport in the photosphere that only use photospheric flows, except for the most important part, which is you got to get the flux in the surface first. But given that you've got flux in the surface, by moving things around in the photosphere, you can mimic much of what you see for the solar cycle. And then finally, the third big problem, how do you heat the corona, accelerate the solar wind? There again, it may very well be fine scale footpoint motion with magnetic fields and basically nanoflare small eruptions that are doing that. So in all three of these cases, photospheric flows can play some part, so it behooves us to try to understand them. What I've done are data simulations, and I apologize to this group, there's no real MHD in this. It's purely, you know, a forward problem where I'm going to simulate the data, but in doing so, hopefully we'll learn something about what the sun does. And you do that with spherical vectors. You've got three complex coefficients for each L and M, one representing radial flows that goes like spherical harmonics L and M at a co-latitude or polar angle theta and an azimuth angle phi. And then there's a poloidal part given by the S's that have horizontal divergence but no horizontal curl, and a toroidal part that has horizontal curl but no divergence. R and S are linked through the mass continuity equation, that basically S is proportional to the radial derivative of R by mass continuity. So those two are linked, have to be linked in phase. The phase of the toroidal component you have to figure out. It's not necessarily in phase with the others. Given those vector velocities, you then need to project it onto the line of sight, and this is all the geometric factors that come in for a B angle, which is the latitude at disk center for the observation, and again, at a given latitude and longitude, this gives you the line of sight velocity, and that's what's observed with MDI. Part of that process to make it realistic, though, is you have to convolve this with the point spread function for the instrument. And so what I do is I look at a given pixel, find its latitude and longitude, find the vector velocity, and then look at subpixels within that pixel and integrate over it to get a velocity. If you don't integrate over it, you end up with severe aliasing problems as you get close to the limb, because you're picking out, you're going from one pixel to another, you'll jump all the way across a cell to another cell. So I average over pixel, and then you have to modify that with a modulation transfer function, which is a function of spatial wave number. This is basically 1/2 pixels. And so this is the Nyquist frequency in the image. And this blurs things out and gives you something that looks like MDI. Here's MDI Doppler data with the P-modes removed, and I'll talk in just a second about doing that. Again, it's dominated, of course, by solar rotation, but you can see supergranules primarily, cellular flows across the disk. To get rid of the P-modes, I use a Gaussian weighting function. This is actually the one I proposed for Gong, which is a 17-minute filter. It's a Gaussian weighting that when you multiply by the images and then add them up, you get rid of the P-modes. This is the response. If you just take a 60-minute average, this is the frequency response, where this is how much of the signal is transmitted. 1 means all of it's transmitted. Here's 10%, 1%, 1/10%. And this is versus temporal frequency. P modes are out here at about 3 millihertz. So with a 60-minute average, you've only knocked them down by, a factor of, to 5% or so of their signal. With this 31-minute filter, by the time you get out here to P modes, you're down to, 1 or 2/10% of the signal leaking through. So it basically kills off the P modes very well, so that they're removed from the signal and we only look at the steady flows. All right, my analysis technique takes, again, these time averaged images, removes the convective blue shift, which is just symmetric about disk center, determines rotation, differential rotation, meridional circulation, removes those, and then you're left with the convection pattern, which looks like this in full disk. These images get mapped into heliographic coordinates and then projected onto spherical harmonics to give spherical harmonic spectral coefficients. There's actually an additional step. I have these as every hour for 61 days during 1996. If I look at the stationary component of those spectral coefficients, that's something that doesn't move on the disk of the sun, and I know that's either the axisymmetric flows still in there, or it's an instrumental effect. So I remove that to clean up the data yet again. All right, this is a 2D spectrum that I get out of that. I get amplitudes and phases. Again, the phases look pretty much random there. You get an amplitude as a function of spherical harmonic degree L out to about 1,000, given the size of these images, and azimuthal order M, and there's also the minus M's, but they're just complex conjugate pairs. So given those two things, you can then go back and reproduce the images from these spectra. From that, if you square the amplitudes and sum up over M, you get a spectrum for the convective motions, and this is that plotted as a function of wave number here. This is almost certainly instrumental artifact there, and some of this down bottom here is as well. The real curve probably goes more like that. But it rises to a peak at L of about 120, and at L of 120, this represents a wave number or a wavelength of about 36 megameters. So these are the supergranules. Falls off sharply at higher wave numbers, but that's primarily due to blurring and foreshortening at the limb. And this is where one thing that Aki had me do was, rather than looking at power, which is meters squared per second squared per wave number, if you multiply this by wave number and take the square root, you get what's basically a characteristic velocity as a function of wave number. And so for numbers that are a little easier to see, here's that, which is now a velocity spectrum. Because you're multiplying by wave number, it pushes the peak over a little bit, L of about 140, and again, that represents 30 megameters, and a typical RMS Doppler velocity there at about 100 meters a second. So this is what you get out of the data. What I've done is to try to reproduce that with just a spectrum with a poloidal flows, no radial flows, no toroidal flows, so it's just cellular flows, stuff spreading out on the surface, and an amplitude that depends only upon L, and then just random phases for each of the M's at a given L. Top half of this image is the convection pattern we saw earlier, the bottom half is the simulation. And visually, I challenge you to differentiate between the two because I might have mislabeled which one's which. this is a close-up near disk center, again, of the observed pattern in the data simulation. The data simulation's a little weaker at disk center than the observed, and that's because there's radial flows in there. We'll get to that in a moment. This is, again, the observed power spectrum, and then which is the solid line, and then the dotted line is from my data simulation, and of course, it was trial and error with a number of parameters to make it fit, but the point is I can get a spectrum with the dotted line here that pretty closely matches the observed spectrum.
In the simulation, the phases were randomly added?
Just random phases. This is, again, if you prefer velocity, this is the velocity, and again, closely matches. There's little systematic deviation up here, but we're not sure we get the MTF exactly right, so I'm not going to worry about that for the moment. The thing is, this is what went into it. Those were Doppler velocities with all the foreshortening, the fact that you're only seeing line of sight velocity has been blurred and so forth. What went into that was a two-component spectrum. This is a Lorentzian, peaks about L of 120, and this is the tail end of another one that peaks way out at L of 4,000 or something like that. So again, I can't say what goes on out here. But again, it's a spectrum that has a bump for supergranules. This is velocity now, and actually dips down before it rises off again. I don't see any evidence for, anything specific at mesogranule scales, which is out here at 600 or 700. Let's see. We also have high resolution data from MDI. So this is low resolution near disk center. Here's high resolution again with the same 31-minute filter to get rid of the P modes. And again, you see a lot more fine scale structure here, a lot of signal at disk center, indicating a lot of this is radial velocity rather than just horizontal. And the spectrum of that, again, now we're going from effective spherical harmonic degree of out to L of about 3,000. Here's the supergranule peak in here, kind of ragged, because I think this is just a single image or just a few hours worth of data, but a peak between 1 and 200. A dip out here where the mesogranules ought to be, and then a rise, but then the fall off out here that's, again, almost certainly due to resolution. This is Oki's plot, plotted on here. The solid line is the input spectrum that I require to reproduce the full disk Doppler data. The yellow stuff up here is from simulations that Bob and Oki have done. Looking at the velocity spectrum up there, they seem to come close to matching in here. These are various curves from correlation tracking with La Palma data and I think some of the high resolution MDI data. So, but the nice thing is that they do seem to at least fit fairly well together. There's not huge shifts between them. Again, they seem to match up, but for me, I need this bump in here for supergranules. So to conclude on the photospheric convection spectrum part, I see a continuous spectrum of convective flows from things that we would call giant cells all the way out to granules, but I only see evidence for two distinct modes of convection, namely granulation and supergranulation. All right, changing gears now to look at the radial flow component. Again, with these spectral coefficients, we've got a form for the S's, now we need to get R's and T's. You can get the radial flow by looking at the center to limb variation, that the line of sight velocity at a point X and Y on the disk has a part that is due to horizontal flows directed along the line of sight, but it goes like the sine of the angle from disk center, and the radial part of the flow that varies like the cosine of the angle from disk center. If you square this, there's another component, of course, that's horizontal component that's transverse to your line of sight that you don't see at all. So hence an H1 and an H2. If you square the line of sight velocity over the disk and look at various center to limb distances, it's a function that goes like this with the horizontal and radial part. And then cross terms, the cross terms ought to go to zero. There's no particular reason why you should get a radial flow at one point positively correlated with horizontal velocity along the line of sight versus, line of sight in the opposite direction or anything else. So that ought to go to zero, so you end up with this. So the line of sight component is a function of the angle from disk center, ought to go like the sine squared of the angle from disk center. The intercept at the disk center gives you the radial velocity, and the slope gives you the difference between the horizontal velocity and the radial velocity.
So, I had a question about this cross yeah. velocity term. So isn't that sort of like a Reynolds stress?
It's sort of like a Reynolds stress, but this is between radial flow and horizontal flow on the surface. And in particular, the horizontal component that's along your line of sight. And if you think, consider a convection cell on one side where you've got radial flow upward, it's coming towards you on one side, going away from you on the other side. So even though you've got the same positive velocity, if you go just a little further away from this center one way or the other, you get opposite directions for this. So it should go to zero. We'll get to Reynolds stresses later, because that's the momentum flux.
Need to find the values.
I'm not even sure that does it.
If it goes up, it should move in the retrograde direction.
Near the surface, the Rossby number is very high, so I don't think it's...
Sure, that's why. But then it's probably a smaller curve.
But
if anything, it would be
but then. If it's going the other direction, then you ought to see it one side on one side of the disk and the opposite sign on the other side of the disk.
Wouldn't it be going if it's going in the anti-rotation direction going up, it would be going in the plus rotation direction going down.
Okay, but again, this is an average in annually about this center.
Okay.
All right? Yeah. So you may be right that upward flows are positively correlated with retrograde flows. But on one side of the disk, that means an upward flow is correlated with a red shift. On the other side of the limb, you get an upflow associated with a blue shift. So they cancel out. So I think that's a fairly rigorous, a fairly good assumption as far as that thing disappearing. And more to the point, when you look at the data, it does that. So this is, again, plotting from this center out, again, it's linear in sine squared row, so this is out 60% of the way to the limb, and again, you see the data is the ragged line through there, and there's a straight line fit that gives you something like horizontal velocities of about 250 meters per second and radial velocities of about 30 meters a second. But we can do better. Well, actually, one thing that had come up historically in looking at the radial flows is whether these are actually radial flows in magnetic elements in the network as opposed to larger scale things. So one thing that I did and that had been done before, I think Jacques Beckers did this years ago, was to mask out, you can see the little black dots here, mask out the places where the magnetic field gets above some value. And so if you do that, You get the same result. So it's not, these aren't downflows in magnetic elements that you're seeing, but rather large scale flows. flows that are associated with the pattern itself.
But there's only a small fraction of the area that you're exclusive to this phase.
That's right.
And it was a very low magnetic.
Yeah, this, I neglected to mention that. This is 1996. During the early part of this, there were no spots on the sun at all. Mm-hmm. When they did come out, I mean, there were a few really small ones. So it's that's one of the reasons why I use it for this study, is that it's very clean as far as not having any magnetic junk in it. One thing I can do is to take my spectrum and spherical harmonic spectrum and filter it with various band passes to look at cells of different size and see how this depends upon size of cells. And here's four examples of that. Big, this is basically supergranules here, and then smaller and smaller yet. So I can now look at center to limb variation.
That's incredible.
Pardon me?
That looks incredible.
Yeah, doesn't it look kind of funny? It's as far as, but again, this is.
Looks like filaments.
Yes.
Yeah, but that's the way it looks.
But why?
I don't know exactly, but I know I get exactly the same thing when I do the simulations.
If you're looking mostly at the horizontal velocities, then you're going to see the things that probably were representing the lanes.
Well, but I don't really have lanes in here is the thing.
Yeah.
Well, I know the sun may, but I'll show you in a minute my simulation where you'll see the same sort of patterns. I got random phases in there. There's no connection between the pattern at one wave number and the pattern up here. It's not like you only see this around the edges of supergranules. So I don't know where it comes from. But it is an interesting looking pattern.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is now center to limb variation for each of those nine filters and getting, again, intercept and slope off of these. Here now is the MDI versus simulated for, the full thing, and this is just a section near the equator, and then my nine different filters. And again, you can see, again, it's got the same filamentary structure over here, even in the simulated data, where it's just random phases that know nothing about what the other sizes are doing.
And what are we, that is radial velocity?
No, this is line of sight velocity. But this is part of the study to get radial velocity, which is how big is the signal at dissenter versus, the slope as you go out here in RMS velocity. And so here, this is the observed ratio of vertical velocity to horizontal with the diamonds and the dotted line up here. The dashed line with the triangles is my data simulation. The straight line down here is what I put in the data simulation. This is higher by about the square root of 2. And that's understandable because in the Doppler data, you only see one component of the horizontal velocity. And so when you put the other one in, it's basically square root of 2 sort of effect. So the horizontal velocities are actually underestimated. The vertical velocities, you get pretty good. So but this is what goes in. It's something that goes from 5% up to 12% out here. I strongly suspect that this is not a linear relationship, that it, in fact, does rise up dramatically. In fact, we know out where granules are, it ought to be more like a ratio of 1, of 100%, that there's just as much radial as there is in the horizontal.
Do you interpret this as a size in the aspect ratio of the cells or something like that?
It's basically in the photosphere, how much radial flow is there, yeah. At the photosphere, how much radial flow is there compared to horizontal flow is a function of size. And we know when you go to granules that they're comparable, there's about as much, and again, it depends upon where in the atmosphere exactly you're looking, what line you're using to look at it. But they're comparable, that you see about as much radial flow or vertical flow as horizontal flow. And this is putting numbers on how big, in the photosphere, the radial flows are. One place I want to work this, Jeff Kuhn has this result from MDI of bumps that he sees on the limb of the sun that seem to have some period. I think all he's seeing is supergranules rotating around. But in order to prove that, I need to know what the radial velocity is, how the surface is corrugated just due to supergranulation to see whether it matches what he observes.
So are you saying that the difference in the height is just a ballistic height that you get from that velocity?
Well, yeah. If you've got a flow up, I mean, look at a pot of boiling water. I mean, where the flow's up, I mean, the surface is elevated. Where the flow's down, it's...
Is that consistent?
There's also an opacity effect, so that optical depth, any given optical depth thing is going to also be bumpy.
Yeah.
And that'll have to do with temperature, not just velocity.
Don't make my life complicated. Yes, I know.
But even more than that, there's feculum or writings at the limb. And those are very much larger scale patterns that don't average out as much, and that you should see even stronger. Mm-hmm. You just see, and in many cases, yeah. You've seen surface structures rotate around.
Yeah. Okay, so. Radial flows. I must include a radial component in the spectrum to reproduce the results, and it's something where the radial component is proportional to the horizontal flows, starting off at about 5% and increasing out to L of 1,000 by at least 7%. And again, I strongly suspect that it's nonlinear and ought to look at the higher resolution data to see how it takes off afterwards. But at this point, I now have a handle at least on two of the three coefficients that I need in a good model that characterizes the photosphere. So in conclusion, radial flow is about 10% of the horizontal flow for supergranules, increases a bit as you go out, and that the Doppler velocities underestimate the horizontal flow by a factor of about square root of 2. Next bit, toroidal flows. The solenoidal flows, these are the outflows, have strong radial gradients as you go. If you look at a point on the disk, if you look at the gradients this way, solenoidal flows have strong gradients in that direction and weak gradient tangentially, whereas toroidal flows, any twisting or vorticity you have about this point, you get the opposite effect. You have strong tangential gradients and weak radial gradients.
Why are they asymmetric?
Pardon me?
Why are the toroidal flows asymmetric?
Again, if you think of round cells, same aspect ratio in each direction, then poloidal flows, where it's just spreading out from a center, the line of zero velocity, zero Doppler velocity, is along the tangent line here. Whereas if you've got vorticity about that upflow, then the line of zero velocity is in the radial direction, and you get a strong, you know, blue shift on one side or red shift on one side, blue shift on the other side. It's just how velocities project into the line of sight. Again, foreshortening near the limb is going to weaken all of this, but the point is that this can give you a handle on how much vorticity there is versus just divergence in the photosphere by looking, by taking those gradients and looking. And this shows an example, again, of looking at, like I did in the radial flow study, the mean squared velocity is a function of distance from center to limb. If it's only solenoidal, it's the solid line. If it's only toroidal, it's the dashed line. If the low wave numbers for these up here, it's a little hard to see, but as you get up to higher wave numbers, it's very easy to differentiate between the two by the center to limb variation in that. So this is a study that's I'm still working on as far as trying to get good numbers out of, but I have at least tried to match. Now this is observed. This is a solid line from MDI. The data simulation with about 30% of a toroidal component is the dashed line, and it gets pretty close. So this is a first estimate, but it's still rough for how much vorticity there is. What I really need to do, and haven't done at this point, is to do what I did with the radial study to see how this varies with wave number, how much more vorticity there is at different wave numbers by looking at those two signals.
What does that 30% toroidal mean?
That means that T component that goes into my is about 30% of the S component. So So it's weaker, and it ought to be. If it wasn't weaker, it'd be very obvious in the images. And if you look at the Doppler images, usually the line, the zero velocity line, the neutral line for velocity, cuts through cells along.
So I guess I'm just trying to figure out what this means. So in the horizontal velocities, that there's like a 30% sort of twisting motion.
Yeah.
Relative to the.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Random orientation.
Well, that's another thing I need to look at, and that's, you know, where
is this
I will.
Large scale twisting as opposed to small scale.
This is on the scale of those particular cells, and again these filters went, I think, 128 in wave numbers as you went.
But your 30% is independent of the.
For this, I strongly suspect that it isn't, and I'd like to know how it's related in phase. With a poloidal component, but I haven't done that yet. Okay, so again, these are very preliminary conclusions. Like I said, I've still got a fair bit of work to do here. It looks like about 30% works, but this was before I had a better handle on the modulation transfer function. This afternoon, in fact, I got the MTF from Silvan Korzenek for the 1996 run, so I can at least now put in the actual one. What we had before was we knew the general shape and we knew one point on the line. You know, so it's like, all right. So anyway, and then again, the phase relationship between those needs to be determined. All right, angular momentum transport. Axisymmetric flows like meridional circulation ought to transport angular momentum towards the poles, and yet the equator is fast. So somewhere, non-axisymmetric flows can transport angular momentum towards the equator if you have a correlation between prograde velocities and equatorward velocities. So if prograde and equatorward correlate is greater than zero, you get equatorial acceleration. Peter Gilman came up with an idea back in 77 for doing this by looking at Doppler data, basically looking at the mean squared Doppler velocity signal, and that it ought to be stronger east of the central meridian than west of the central meridian if angular momentum is being transported towards the equator. So the top half of this picture is for large-scale cells with vorticity, with the effects of rotation in them, but the cells are elongated in the north-south direction. And what you find then is that the Coriolis force turning the vectors makes things moving towards the poles move retrograde, things moving towards the equator move prograde, so that gives you the right sense for accelerating the equator. And you see in the image on the top here, you get a strong signal east of the central meridian because those vectors are more or less along the line of sight. As you get over here, those vectors in that direction are transverse to your line of sight, and so the signal gets real weak. On the other hand, if you had cells that were oriented east-west, which is represented on the bottom here, effect of the Coriolis force now takes stuff going towards the equator, moving retrograde, stuff moving towards the pole, going prograde, you get an opposite flux of angular momentum, but you get the western hemisphere having a stronger RMS signal than the eastern hemisphere. So one way to look for evidence of these velocity correlations is just to look eastern hemisphere, western hemisphere, and see whether there's a stronger signal one place or the other. So this is for the full data. Again, looking at the mean squared velocity as a function of distance from center to limb. And again, there's that same line that we had before, but we see that the line's slightly different depending upon whether you're looking east or west. So here's the west is strong, the east is somewhat weaker, means angular momentum's going towards the poles. It's a weak effect, but again, it's 5 meters a second here, and the sigma is about one, so it's tentative, and even more tentative than that might indicate. This is now looking with those different spectral filters for the low wave numbers, supergranules, things twice as big as supergranules and things even, or twice as small and things even smaller. It seems strongest for the supergranules, approaches zero as you go to really small things, and this is what you'd expect, that the effects of rotation ought to be weaker on small things than it is on supergranules. It seems to head back to zero here, and the big question is, does it cross zero and become positive, become an equatorward flux as you get to really small wave numbers? That's the question. However, I don't have an answer. But because one thing is, we thought there might be instrumental effects, so one thing we looked at was, let's look just at the P-mode signal. If this is instrumental, that there's something wrong with one side of the disk versus the other in MDI, then you ought to see the same thing when you look at the P-mode signal. And this is a result of looking at these images where now I've subtracted from the original image my mean velocity thing, the 31-minute average, so you only see the P-mode signal. Of course, it's got a huge intercept. They're mostly radial flows, little horizontal, but there's also little difference between east and west hemisphere. So it didn't look like it was an instrumental problem. Furthermore, if you look at cell shape, look at the amplitudes as a function of M over L. When M is zero, these are they're axisymmetric bands, east-west bands. When M is equal to L, they're stripes north and south. With MDI, this is what I get for the power an amplitude normalized to some average in here. It's a function of M over L. So again, these are stripes east-west, these are stripes north-south. The dotted line in here is what I get when I analyze the data with the simulated data, where there's absolutely no preference for one or the other. And the point here is that there appears to be more power out here for the banded stuff stretched east-west, than stuff stretched north-south. And that also fits in with the momentum fluxes being the wrong direction. Well, the wrong direction, towards the poles instead of the equator.
But I mean, this is momentum flux at the photosphere.
At the photosphere.
Yeah, the density is negligible here. It's not really clear that that relates to the actual...
That's right. But wouldn't it be nice if you could see a signal in here of an equatorward flux of angular momentum at some size?
Well, yeah. If these are sort of cells, then doesn't the opposite effect happen deeper down?
Doesn't the opposite effect happen deeper down?
You know, where most of the mass is?
Certainly the models for convection in spherical shells show that you do get equatorward flux transport, momentum transport, deep within the sun. And the question here was, can you see that in the surface layers? And it appears I don't. In fact, if anything, this shows that you've got an added loss term as far as supergranules taking angular momentum and sending it to the poles.
You're correlating east-west and north-south.
East-west and north-south.
What about correlating east-west and vertical velocities?
That's a little harder to do. But again, it could show up in this east-west thing, as Axel mentioned earlier on. If radial flows tend to be prograde as they come up, then yeah, it ought to be a strong signal one side, weak the other. Yeah, and I guess trying to disentangle those two could be difficult. I'll have to think about that.
And I should maybe mention that finite correlations have in fact been observed, or have been claimed, in sunspot.
In sunspot motions, that's right. In proper motion of sunspots, there appears to be this, but you know, there's also Joy's law and what happens when flux tubes come out, spread apart along Joy's law. They tend to give you, in fact, I think the right correlation, just, you know, if they pop up with Joy's law and the leading polarity heads one way, the opposite, the following polarity the other, it gives you the correlation such that the equator ought to be accelerated.
Yeah.
So, but the big question is that really...
That's the spots. We know that they don't move the equators very close.
Yes. Yeah.
But we don't actually know at which depth they are at.
Okay. So, conclusion on this, it appears that angular momentum is transported towards the poles and supergranules, but I've still got a lot of work to do on this. In particular, there are instrumental problems that can hamper this. There are focus variations across the disk. There's astigmatism in it. and those may severely impact some of these conclusions. And so one thing I did while I was up at Stanford yesterday was to try to find out who has information on this. Sylvain Korzenek does. He's got an MTF that is angle dependent, and they know that there are astigmatism problems and focus problems. So I need to deal with those before I make any final conclusions on what we get out of this. Okay, the final topic I want to get into is the time dependence, how these things rotate, and how long do they live as a function of size. This is a movie of 4 days worth of data. And you can see the line going through here is moving at basically the Carrington rate. Come on, go again. You can see the pattern tending to move with that. What I've done to look at both rotation rate and lifetime is to map the data back into heliographic coordinates. So this is now longitude and latitude, and take strips at a given latitude, and what I've taken is basically a 7-pixel strip at a given latitude in one image, and here's an image 8 hours later, and see how those strips have to be shifted in order to get the highest correlation. So the shift that gives you the highest correlation tells you something about the rotation rate and the strength of the correlation. Now, how high that correlation is as a function of time will tell you something about the lifetimes. So we'll get both of those pieces of information out of it. Oki didn't like my filters that were linear in L. I listened to them too much. So I changed my filters to being logarithmic in L. So now, again, in terms of logarithm, they're equally spaced, L of 8, 16, 32, 64, so forth. Again, here's the supergranules. The only really useful ones are these five here. These, the lowest wave number ones, you can see when you watch the movies, there's still a lot of noise in there. But again, I can filter the data, make images, make these maps from these different sizes and see it's a function of size, how fast things rotate. This is for a 1 hour difference. Again, I've got 4 days of this data every hour, so I can look at hour zero and hour one, and then hour one and hour two, and so forth, and step through it. So I've got 96 different measurements, albeit not all independent, but 96 measures of both the rotation rate and correlation coefficient. This is L, well, this is the supergranules, the curve up here. You see for things smaller than supergranules, they appear to rotate more slowly. For things larger than supergranules, they rotate more rapidly. So as the feature size increases, the rotation rate increases, and I can reproduce that with the model. Again, as the feature size of the feature increases, going up here, the rotation rate increases, and I can toggle back and forth between these, and you can see that it's pretty close. There's also an interesting effect that the rotation rate changes depending upon the time lag between the images, such that as you go to longer and longer time lags between the images, the pattern appears to rotate faster and faster. And again, I can reproduce that with the data as well. So here's, let's see, there's the real, there's the simulation, same sort of thing. Thought the explanation for this was in, Hank's smiling over there, he knows the answer. Was that rotation rate increases inwards, big cells ought to extend deeper and feel the faster rotation rate inwards. Big cells also live longer, so that as you go from small to big, you ought to sample faster and faster rotation as you go in. And as you wait longer and longer in time, the smaller stuff dies off, so your filters are weighted more and more towards the big stuff, so there ought to be shift to faster and faster. I thought this was a great explanation. Fits the data perfectly. But I didn't tell you what I put in my data. What I put in my data was a pattern that doesn't depend upon size of the cells at all. It's the same rotation rate regardless of size of cells, and yet I reproduced the results. What I did was Again, the coefficients up here, again, they're complex. If you add a phase difference that depends upon m and some rotation rate, and this is the rotation rate here, this m over l gives you the differential rotation. Now, if you take that out, you just get solid body rotation. But again, it doesn't depend upon the size of the features, but reproduces the results. And if I go back, the rotation rate I put in is actually the outer envelope on this. It goes up to about, peaks at about 470 nanohertz. So what I'm really finding is that the pattern, and I think what it is that I'm looking at a Doppler pattern. I'm not looking at a scalar feature. And if you consider near the equator, and think of a cell on the east side of the equator, it's going to have blue shifts towards disk center and red shifts towards the limb. As that cell rotates across the central meridian to the west side, the blue shifts and red shifts reverse, but it's still the same cell. But you get a phase difference just due to the fact that it's a Doppler pattern that's rotating. So I need to work out the details and make sure it's all in there, but my suspicion is that all of this is explained by that phenomena. And what I see in this is consistent with them all having the same rotation rate. It's faster than the surface. In fact, it still may be faster than things inside, but it's not a function of time difference, and it's not a function of size of cells. Okay.
Faster than the surface, you say. Does it correspond roughly to the peak that you have in the shear layer?
Yes. It does. All right, so in conclusion, large cells appear to rotate more rapidly than small cells, and larger lags appear to give larger rotation rates, but these effects are reproduced in the data simulation with a rotation rate that does not vary with time or wave number. Okay, final thing, and this is quick because I haven't finished it, lifetime study. Again, it's basically as you have a larger and larger time lag between images, the correlation coefficient that you get in doing these studies drops. So here's for the supergranules. It drops immediately, and I think I'm quite sure this is just due to noise that, from one image to the next, there's noise in the data. So there's immediate drop, and then there's a slow decline out here. Here's things a quarter the size of supergranules, and you see the drop is very big. And it's quickly getting down to where they're hardly correlated at all there. So I haven't finished this yet, but this is the handle I will get on how long do these things live. This is a function of size. One thing that comes in handy with the data simulation is that some of this is just due to the fact that they're Doppler velocities, and so you're going to get a drop, even if they live forever. You're going to get a drop in correlation just because you're seeing different aspects as they rotate. But I can basically calibrate that out by using the data simulation. And so again, what I intend to do here in the lifetime study in the simulation is now add random phases here. So sum up as you go from one image to the next, just random bumps in the phase such that, and the size of that will depend upon the size of the cell. So 4 hours later, one size of cell will be uncorrelated. For supergranules, it may be a day later or whatever. So this is the way I intend to simulate it. So, all right, I can tell already, that big cells live longer than small cells. But again, I can quantify that using the data simulations, which brings me to the final conclusion, which is that data simulations and forward modeling can be extremely valuable in interpreting the observations. And with that, I thank you for your attention. I got through 50 slides. Questions? Numbed.
20% toroidal velocity sounds like a lot. Is there no way to observe it directly in Doppler? Because I never heard about it.
Well, yeah, and that's where, if If the phases are still random, then it's going to be hard to see. If they were strongly correlated with the poloidal flows, then in fact it ought to be immediately evident in the data if it were that big. That in fact you'd see what you would see instead of circles. You know, if I go way, let's see. See if I can do this right. If you look at this pattern, it looks like the line of zero velocity is basically circles around the center of the disk. If there were a strong toroidal component in phase with that, you would get spirally type patterns in this. The line of zero velocity will be twisted one way or the other. And so you'd see, in fact, I've done it, in the data simulation, it's obvious when you look, no, that's not the sun, because you get these spiral patterns that you don't see in the real data. But again, that's the 30% take with a box of salt I really need to do quite a bit more work on that to really get a good handle on it. It's just, no, it looked like I went a long ways towards reproducing simulations, but that was before I even had an inkling of what the blurring was within MDI, as far as what the modulation transfer function was. I've got a better handle on that now, so I need to go back and redo that study with the proper blurring to see, because that's going to change what you see near the limb in particular, and that was part of what I was fitting, was I wanted to fit that behavior from discenter to limb. I need to redo that before I write anything. So this is all just between us, right?
Go ahead. I was just wondering about your model has absolutely a random phases part.
Yes.
The power spectrum, the phases are random, and still you produce the data. That's a bit surprising,
yeah,
because cells are organized structures where the phases are not random.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, this is something that Oki and Bob have mentioned to me, that if they took their models, took the spectrum within their models and then gave them random phases, it wouldn't look at all like what they see.
Somehow.
But there's something else. There is this.
Yeah.
I measure phases. Unfortunately, this is 1,000 points across here, and you're only seeing it in 400 points or something, so you don't see the details. When you see the details, there's some interesting patterns in this that I'm not sure are reproduced in the real data. So phases is something I still need to look at.
Yeah, but the absolute phases, of course, are very difficult to handle because you need the reference.
Well, my point is, and I have to show you, on the computer where I've got it in. Well, do I have it on here? I may. Let me do it later. But if you actually look at this, the interesting thing is that there's actually patterns in here that it looks like adjacent sizes are linked in phase somehow. That they only change slowly in phase as you go. There's these little arcs and things in there that suggests that there is phase locking between various modes that isn't in my model. So I still need to look at it, but nonetheless, when you look at that, it's like, looks good.
I had a question about the ratio of the radial velocity to
the horizontal
velocity as a function of the size scale. Does anybody see anything like that in their convection simulations? What the ratio of
radial
velocity to
horizontal
velocity? It's a clear function of the size. Hmm. Hans Gunther has used our code to look at, I think it's 30 millimeter line stuff. The measurement of the bigger sizes, the horizontal velocities become much larger than the regular velocities. Whereas at the granulation level, they're about equal, and they're quite different over the super granulation.
Why is the convection? It seems to me like it's actually picking out a different shape for the convective cells. If the ratio of the velocities is changing as a function of size, doesn't that suggest that the shape is different? As a function of depth, the aspect ratio is changing.
I think it's largely just size compared to scale height that you're looking at. I mean, if you're much bigger than a scale height, then I think you end up with things largely horizontal.
We're fixed at a
given. Yeah, we're looking. We're looking right at the surface. Where okay, you know scale height's 300 yeah. kilometers or something.
Except the effects of stuff that's from looking at large scales, you're seeing the effects of stuff that's down deep.
Yeah. Supergranules are seen to go at least 8 megameters down or something. And I had hoped I'd know how deep they go by how they rotate, but now, damn, what happened?
But there's somewhat significant that the rotation rate agrees with the peak ending, yeah.
Well, but that means that, you know, even small things here, mesogranule sized things are moving at that rate as well. Does that mean that they feel?
Well, is that fair? Because you have different curves.
I can compare LL512, which is you know a quarter the size of a quarter the size of supergranule, so eight kilometers or 8 megameters across. I can compare what I get with the simulation with what I get in the data and. It looks the same, and it's with a rotation rate that is 470 nanohertz at the equator, which is fast. Curiouser and curiouser. I don't know the answer as far as you know why. I thought they'd be going slower, and that you know this was something that made them look like they were going faster, but it. You know, I know what I've put in particular for the equatorial rate, I know exactly, and it's 469.36 nanohertz, give or take
somewhat,
a picohertz.
It's somewhat consistent with Peter Foucault's interpretation of the shear layer, though. It may not be very significant, but he has this view in which you have cells, supergranules, in which the there's a slight tendency for angular conservation.
Yeah. In the smaller cells, you don't expect rotation to be strong enough to produce pressure gradients that balance Coriolis force. So they ought to tend to conserve angular momentum in radial flows.
Then it would not be consistent because that flow would also carry the small cells with it. So you would have a difference between the patterns
of the small. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And here you're going to take cells that are much bigger than supergranules as well. And they extend down deeper than the surface shear layer.
Yeah.
What's the depth of the shear layer for me as a
molecule? 5 to 7% of the radius, isn't that right?
Yes.
So it's 35,000, 50,000 kilometers down.
So you really should see an effect.
When I'm looking at things that are 120 megameters across, you'd expect they might go down that deep. They might. I don't know. Again, all I know is the data's consistent, very consistent. In fact, I was shocked when you know I put in this constant rotation rate and out drop immediately both of those results.
You'll be able to put error bars on say the measurements of the rotation
rate. Yeah, I need to get you know in fact I fit curves through that with you know low order polynomials and from those you know I can compare to and look at the differences and see you know how significant are they and what might they mean. Yeah. All right.
Okay. All right. Questions.
Thank you.
Don't forget for